You know, the first pulsar was discovered by chance by Jocelyn Bell and Anthony Hoish in 1967, who actually thought they were going to study distant galaxies at the time. They have since, people have found, astronomers, at least 1,500 pulsars to date now, maybe more. At one time, they thought that they might be coming from an extraterrestrial civilization. Well, and most scientists simply said, no, that's just not the case. However, our guest tonight, Dr. Paul Lavalette, talks about the talk of the galaxy in ET Message for us. Back with him in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Paul, another riveting theory here, the talk of the galaxy. Let's talk a little bit. First of all, in scientific terms, let's talk about these pulsars. Technically, what do they seem to be?
Okay. Well, we have to come up with a new model to explain these, because what you see is that they're, the most unusual ones are located at key places in the galaxy. They're making geometrical relationships to the center of the galaxy and to the two closest supernova remnants, which were whose detonation times were at the time the superwave passed us at the end of the Ice Age. Just random occurrence, because if you do the statistics on this, if this was due to chance, you're coming up with something like one chance in 10 to the 28th power. It's just a huge number as being due to just random chance for this, these alignments to occur.
Sure.
So the idea of a spinning neutron star that was proposed years back to explain this has problems with a lot of aspects, that it doesn't... There's a lot of contradictions. This has been noted by many astronomers, that as they discover more and more about the phenomenon, they find it's more complex than they thought. In fact, even on a given pulsar, the various characteristics will become self-contradictory in terms of the model that they had, this idea of a neutron star that was spinning and shooting out a beam of radiation would periodically sweep by in our direction. The model that I've proposed is that they are neutron stars, and neutron stars that are emitting cosmic rays.
Mm-hmm.
But a civilization has used them as energy sources for transmitting pulse synchrotron beams towards us. And it would be done in this fashion. They would project to the surface of the neutron star force fields that would be able to decelerate the cosmic rays. Now, this is a technology that's been developed in black programs, and we know of it from various stories. For example, I interviewed a lady who was had been on a camping trip in the Superstitious Mountains in Arizona, and they were woken up at night, and they look up in the sky, and here are these luminous spheres rising up from behind the mountain, going up and splitting into several spheres, doing various circles around, and then eventually coming back down behind the mountain. And this was going on for hours. Apparently, that was near a military installation, and it seems that what they were observing was a military test of a technology for being able to create force fields in the sky. Tom Bearden has talked a lot about this technology.
Yes.
He refers to these as scalar waves. They're used. In my book, Talk of the Galaxy, I give an explanation of how these can be produced. I believe that this is used by advanced civilizations to create these beams remotely. So they would have their generators for this a ways away from the neutron star, but they would be able to actually create on the surface these disks that would beam out the radiation. And it would be almost like a laser, because the cosmic rays are going close to the speed of light. So when they are decelerated and they produce the synchrotron radiation, it ends up being confined as a beam. So just by turning on and off the disk, they're able to create this pulse phenomenon.
What do you think the purpose of the message might be, Paul?
I think that they're warning us about the superwave. At least the pulsars that are uniquely placed. It's not to say that all the pulsars are involved in this message. I believe that their second purpose is to be used for guidance and interstellar space travel.
Now, how many of these pulsars are aimed at planet Earth, as opposed to being beamed all around the universe, basically,
okay,
or the galaxy?
We're seeing now, we've detected about 1,530, and all the pulsars that we're seeing, those beams are directed towards our sector of the galaxy.
Now, isn't that strange all by itself?
They're beamed towards us.
Okay.
Because if you're outside the beam, you're not going to see it. So this is a model where you don't have a beam sweeping around. You have a stationary beam. In other words, if for navigation, for example, a spaceship would use these as sort of a GPS system to be able to locate itself.
I wonder if it would power itself. Is that possible?
Yeah, because they're using the neutron stars, which are natural sources of cosmic rays, as the power source. When I first was thinking about this, I thought, well, it wouldn't be too hard to create a power source, let's say with a nuclear reactor or something out in space, and use that to power accelerators. I mean, we have the technology to do that type of system very easily, to send a pulsed synchrotron beam to another star. But when you realize that the pulsars that are in binary systems, they're able to look at the orbital dynamics of the pulsar, and the equations work out that it has to be a fairly massive object, about a solar mass or more. So you're sort of left to the idea that these are using neutron stars as their power source.
Paul, what is SETI, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence? What do they say about your theory?
Well, I did call up their office and offered to send them a copy of my book, and they didn't want it.
They didn't want it?
The fellow I spoke to, name is Shostak.
Seth Shostak.
Right. He asked me, has it been published in any referee journals? I said, no. And so because of that, didn't even want to take a look at it.
Next time we have Seth on the show, because he pops up quite often, I'll kind of mention this book to him, see what he says.
The reason why I haven't, there's a reason, is that to understand this requires a long discussion. It's really a book-length discussion. And that's not something that's done easily in a scientific paper. I have presented at the American Astronomical Society a presentation of highlighting a few of the main points.
How was that received?
I didn't get any criticism at all. There was a couple questions at the end, and then people scurried off to their other meetings because there were simultaneously many sessions going on. Actually, at that meeting, this was in year 2000, and I made a video of that lecture in case people are interested in the Talk of the Galaxy video. I had a booth there and had the manuscript. It was in the early stages, but I had manuscripts available for astronomers if they were interested. And I stopped and interviewed them, asked if they were interested in extraterrestrial communication. And about half weren't really interested. But of the other half, two-thirds were willing to come and listen to what I had to say. And then the other third didn't believe, it would be possible, would be contacted, even though they were interested.
Well, these pulses, Paul, obviously it's not Morse code. So what is the code? How do we decipher these messages, these pulses?
Well, I haven't actually deciphered the signals. What I've noticed is their locations. And through their locations, there's a geometrical message that they're conveying. But there may indeed be a message in the signals themselves. In fact, I have some data from one pulsar, the Vela pulsar. And it's a matter of getting the people interested to do the analysis and who have the equipment.
Can it be decoded eventually, you think, if indeed your theory is correct?
Oh, yeah. It's a matter if there is interest to do it, it could be done. If there is information in the signal, there should be non-randomness to that the emission. Current theories, even though they talk about the pulses being regular in terms of the lighthouse model beam sweeping by, the actual generation of the emissions is supposed to be more or less erratic, just due to cosmic rays coming and interacting with the magnetic field. So it would be totally surprising if there was an order to the signals themselves. So that's definitely the next test. It would be to look at the signals.
I want to read a quote from the back of your book because it's important and you'll understand when it's done. Dr. Paul LaViolette systematically and eloquently presents an audacious hypothesis that the signals and locations of many pulsars provide evidence of extraterrestrial intelligence. Whatever the significance of his data and conclusions, this is a book well worth reading by those who ponder the great questions of life in the cosmos. That quote, given to you by our dear friend, the late Dr. Eugene Malev, who was murdered almost a couple years ago. That sad story all by itself, Paul. But what a wonderful individual he was. Yes. Obviously, thought very highly of your work.
Yes. He was very supportive. I can give you an idea. On your website, I had put a picture of a certain part of the galaxy showing some pulsars. Which would help to illustrate. This is something that's difficult to convey over the phone unless you have pictures. I don't know. Most of the people probably aren't in front of a computer.
Well, we got a lot in front of a computer, believe it or not. Pretty computer savvy group here.
Well, there is this picture I put there of the Sagitta constellation region. It's a sky map. And it's plotted in terms of galactic coordinates. So horizontal would be the galactic equator, and then vertical would be the angular distance away from there. And plotted locations of pulsars. And the reason I picked this particular place to look at is that there's a point there about 57.24 degrees from the galactic center, which is what I call the galactic one radian point. Now, this is something that the radian concept is something that you would expect could be used in an extraterrestrial communication. Because in extraterrestrial communication, you want to pick concepts that would be universal, like in mathematics, for example, sure, or physics, that would be understandable to those other civilizations. So you're trying to bridge the language barrier. And With the radian concept, what you're doing is you're taking the radius of the circle and you're mapping it out around the circumference. And you come to an angle in terms of our degree system. It comes out to 57.295 degrees. Now, they have actually indicated this point in the galaxy where the center, the other end of that arc would be at the galactic center. So in other words, they've swept out one radian from the galactic center and they put a very unique pulsar there to mark it. I show this there. It's the pulsar 1937 plus 21. It's a millisecond pulsar. In fact, it's the fastest pulsing pulsar in the sky.
Is this a roadmap kind of leading us to them?
What it shows is they're not all hostile. They're actually, there's very highly developed galactic civilization or a group of civilizations that are trying to help us. They're trying to warn us about this phenomenon, which would be the natural thing to talk about.
You know, okay, what makes you think, because we haven't been able to decode this, what makes you think that's the message, that they're warning us about a cosmic wave as opposed to a message of, hey, we're out here, I'm calling, something like that?
Right. Okay, well, if you take that one radian arc and instead of sweeping it out angularly or to the side,
all right, sort of,
you take as a measuring tape, now think of it as a measuring tape, and you go from the galactic center to us, you'll find it ends right where we are. So in other words, if we're at the center of the circle and the galactic center is on the circumference, that angular distance they're measuring for us is the distance from the center of the galaxy to us.
Okay.
Then you look at our neighborhood, and you see that the two most unique pulsars in our neighborhood, and actually are among the most unique in the entire sky, are marking supernova remnants that like the Vela, which is the closest of the young supernova remnants, closest to the solar system. And then the Crab Nebula, which is the youngest, closest supernova remnant that's the youngest of all, because it only happened about 970 or so years ago, when it, 1054 AD, when the Chinese astronomers noted the explosion.
So they might be sending us some old messages, huh? Or do you think it's just continual?
The pulsars?
Yeah.
To have done this feat, it means they had to be there in the sky a long time, because some of these pulsars are 50,000 light years away. In other words, this was, you're left to, you know, in disbelief, because you see the immensity of the project that would have been necessary for all these signals from different points in the galaxy to arrive and spell out this message. And you realize how, you know, we certainly couldn't have done it. How could anybody else have done it? I mean, the only other alternative you're left with is the universe is conscious, and it's trying to communicate to us that this is a spiritual phenomenon. In Talk of the Galaxy, I've tried to put it in terms of, well, it could be also explained by a civilization that has exceptionally advanced technologies. In some places, they would have had to actually, I believe, move neutron stars through the sky to do this, to position them in the proper place. Because the chances of them finding a neutron star at the exact right place is very difficult to imagine. They've also, in one case, oriented the orbital plane of the binary, so it's passing in our direction, the so-called eclipsing binary. There's very uniquely, for example, the second fastest pulsing pulsar has its orbital plane oriented towards us, and it's only about 5 degrees away from the other pulsar we just mentioned, the millisecond pulsar.
All right, well, stay with us. We're going to talk some. I want to get your take on the Big Bang theory, Paul, when we come back with our guest, Dr. Paul LaViolette. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. Hey, next hour, we'll open up the phone lines, give you an opportunity to chat with our guest, Dr. Paul LaViolette, about pulsars and also Earth on Fire and some other interesting facets that we're discussing tonight. By the way, let you know, Art's prediction show will be this Friday. He's also going to do a part two live prediction show this coming Saturday, and then I'll be live with you on New Year's Day, January 1st, with my own prediction show, because we're bringing in guests who are going to make the predictions. So a whole week long, weekend long of predictions for you right here on Coast to Coast AM. We'll be back in a moment. Paul, do these pulsar signals ever die out, or do they just keep coming over and over again?
Yeah, they've been there for quite a while. They keep coming to us. So that's the nice thing about it is that it's a phenomenon that's persisting long enough that scientists are able to document it. All this stuff that I discuss in my book has been published in refereed scientific journals. So there's no question that it exists. People can see what I've written and go to the original papers, check all the calculations, and they will, if they read carefully what I've said, come to the same conclusion that either this is just a random occurrence that's totally freak, like one chance in 10 to the 28th or 10 to the 30th, or there's some sort of planning here where there was an intent. I wanted to finish up what I was saying about why it is that this had led me to conclude that it was a message dealing with the superwave. It has to do with those two supernova remnants I mentioned. It's sort of like they're calling attention to these two remnants. And when you go and you look at the times when the supernova occurred, they occurred at the time that the superwave was passing through, passing that star. In other words, it's as if the superwave detonated the explosion. Perhaps it was the gravity wave that was associated with the superwave that could have been enough to trigger an unstable star to explode. Or it could have been dust that it was being pushed onto the star that caused it to become active and explode. Whatever the cause, you look at the timing of the explosions relative to the position of where the superwave would have been, and you see that there was this effect. It sort of maps out the superwave as it proceeded away from the galactic center. First, it was the Vela supernova explosion, which occurred about 800 light years from us, very close to us, and that would have been way back about 12,000 years ago or so. Then the Crab supernova occurred, which was in the direction away from the galactic center. So it's sort of like mapping out the direction of the progress. And actually, it was this, because at the time I was studying pulsars and becoming amazed about their regularity and so on. And when I saw this, that was actually a key piece of information that helped me realize about the galactic superwave phenomenon. Because I had at that time, just before that, discovered about the message of Sagittarius arrow indicating from myth about the Sagittarius aiming at the heart of the scorpion and that trajectory passing very close to the galactic center indicating this explosion gave an actual date. And then seeing this, I realized that this was not just an explosion that occurred out in space and had nothing to do with us. This is something that actually moved towards us and actually was able to trigger a supernova explosion. In fact, I spent a lot of time discussing the Crab supernova remnant.
Yes.
It appears that has been engineered. The shape, turns out it's a prolate ellipsoid, and it's the exact shape that the superwave event horizon has as it's viewed close to the present time, actually at the time of the explosion of that supernova remnant.
To orchestrate that shape, it was monumental. How do you think they did this?
That's the thing. You see this, and you're left in disbelief. It's like as if they created a map for us using a stellar explosion. It's oriented parallel to the galactic equator and rotated 90 degrees so we can see its shape. And that ellipse is the way the superwave event horizon looks to us, because if you take an ellipse, you have two points. One in this case would be the galactic center and the other the Earth. And so one of the lines you would draw out would be the cosmic rays going out to the horizon, and from the horizon would be the electromagnetic waves coming back to us. And that traces out an ellipse, and that's what we see as the galactic background radiation. It has that particular brightness pattern. In other words, a shape like that would explain that pattern.
What if the messages, Paul, don't come from extraterrestrials, but come from the Creator?
Yeah, that's always a possibility to consider. That's an option that's open to people to interpret this.
You have come up with a lot of interesting theories. There's another one in a book that you've written called Subquantum Kinetics. What is that?
Well, that's a physics theory that a whole new approach. And among other things, it solves a lot of problems that physics has currently run into. You would call it a unified field theory. It's bringing physics closer to the life sciences, like biology, sociology, this branch of science. It's taking what I did is take systems concepts and bring them into physics. Physics had been an area where this hadn't been done before. And what it was triggered, the concept that triggered this for me was the finding about Ilya Prigozhin's work and other scientists, Nicholas, they were writing about reaction-diffusion systems. Mm-hmm. These are, for example, chemical reactions that produce wave patterns. So these are chemical waves. These are different from mechanical waves. This is something we've just discovered in the last 40 years or so. And so what I did was to say, suppose that there's an ether that's reacting just like a chemical reaction system.
All right.
Which was a totally new concept, because there was the ether concepts from the 100 years ago, but they were mechanical like ethers, and they were talking about inert, sort of an inert substance that was unchanging. Now, this is different. This is where you have, it's like an alchemical process that's going on, where etherons are reacting with each other and changing. And if you can imagine a fourth dimension which these reactions are going on, and if you could map this out as an arrow, because it's they're going in one direction, all these mm-hmm. reactions are going in one direction, and at one point in this process is where we're located. So you have to think fourth dimensionally here. So in a way that etherons are transmuting into our physical three-dimensional space, and also leaving, transmuting out. And in that process, they're creating physical forms. And basically, I took the models that we've developed for chemical kinetics, for explaining how chemical waves emerge in out of a initially uniform state, and applied them to physics. For example, the Big Bang Theory is totally different from the Big Bang Theory. Big Bang Theory has everything coming in one explosion.
Which I don't think you believe in, do you?
No. Well, I've disproved the Big Bang Theory, a paper I published in the Astrophysical Journal back in 1985. I took existing cosmological data, and I plotted the Big Bang Theory prediction, which is the expanding universe mm-hmm. concept, and the tired light model, which is the idea that the universe is not expanding, but that the redshift of the light from the galaxies is due to a loss of energy. And consistently, the tired light model fell closer to the data trend. Now, why is this hadn't been discovered before? Well, usually cosmologists would plot their data only on one test, and then they would adjust their model to fit the data, and they called those evolutionary corrections. Now, what I did is I did a systems approach, and I presented four different cosmology tests all at once. and put no assumptions in. And so you have a even playing field. Now, if the Big Bang theorists wanted to put in their evolutionary adjustments to pull their model closer to the data on one test, they would have to apply that same reasoning to the other test, and they would find their model goes further away. So it's like a Chinese handcuff. It's the ultimate test for a theory. And that paper was cited frequently, including by some of the top cosmologists who did reviews.
So you believe, basically, though, that matter energy is constantly being created?
Right. That's the alternative that I'm proposing, and that there's a continuous creation. There was no one big event. It's an event that's going on continuously. And
always was?
No. The ether was always there.
Okay.
Reacting, but you could say there was a beginning to the first particles of matter coming into being. But it could have been 100 trillion years ago. I mean,
sure.
You're not limited. See, the Big Bang Theory is limited by the light horizon, how
That's a good point. 14 billion years or a little less, right?
Yeah. You can't really stretch it much beyond that. It has to do with the rate of expansion that they perceive from the redshift. As soon as you get rid of that, you're not hemmed in by that any longer. And when you're dealing with continuous creation, it's an exponential growth process. And the part where it was just beginning to form, where particles were coming into being, had not yet formed stars, that would have been the longest part of your growth curve. In this physics, when gravity wells form, the process accelerates enormously because gravity wells create what I call supercritical regions. They're fertile regions. This whole system, it's a nonlinear physics that's involved here. In other words, the ether is it's a nonlinear process that's generating everything. And you have both supercritical and subcritical regions, just like this is terminology is referred to in a nuclear reactor. A nuclear reactor is a kind of nonlinear system. In a supercritical region, there tends to be amplification. And in the case of a nuclear reactor, it could go critical and explode.
If you're correct, what's the significance of your theory as opposed to the single Big Bang theory?
What is the significance?
Yes.
Okay, well, first of all, it fits the data better on the cosmology test. You take care of a lot of the problems that have emerged, have been cited about problems the Big Bang Theory has. For example, they see galaxies that are supposed to be only 600,000 years old, fully developed, and there's just not enough time for them to have formed. This wouldn't be a problem with continuous creation. They find these structures, immense structures, in space that are, for example, groupings of galaxies, superclusters, that have a periodicity. It's almost like a giant wave pattern that goes for 5 to 10 billion light years.
If this energy, Paul, is still being created, does that tell you then that this universe is growing at a tremendous clip? It's got to, right?
Right. In fact, first of all, every body is, according to this physics, is growing at a certain rate. Now, the Earth, not very fast, but there are some theories that suggest, well, maybe the fact the continent separated wasn't due entirely to just the convective motions. There might have actually been a change of the radius of the planet. But there are certain restrictions there that you have to place. The fastest growth would be with the largest bodies. For example, the galactic core would be growing, creating matter within itself at the fastest rate, not only matter but energy. So this explains where these core explosions come from. In other words, this leads to a different theory of galactic cores, that they're not black holes. And in fact, a lot of astronomers now have turned away from black holes because they are... they're finding all sorts of problems. For example, they find galaxies, quasars, where they formerly thought there was a black hole generating all this energy at the center, but yet they see that the area has been swept clean of dust, so there's nothing to power it, for it to gobble up. The same for our own galactic center. We see matter moving out, but nothing moving in. The area near the center has been swept clean. So it's providing an answer there. I call these mother stars. They're indeed massive. Like in the case of the galactic core, it'd be 2 million solar masses approximately.
Do you believe, Paul, that there are other universes, parallel universes?
That's another thing that falls out of this is the possibility for parallel universes. They would be formed from the ether, sort of upstream, and there's certain criteria that are needed to form the universe. It's actually, believe it or not, very simple. The reactions can be very simple. You need two ether streams that are crossing and interacting, and to produce also a loop process. And the ancient myths have encoded this alchemic science, actually. For example, the Ankh, I believe the Egyptian Ankh, is a depiction of the reaction pattern that creates the universe.
How do they know all these things, though, Paul? That's what just boggles my mind. I mean,
you could theorize this way, that this isn't the first time they discovered reaction systems, chemical reaction systems that produce wave patterns. Maybe they discovered this long ago and developed a cosmology based on this phenomenon. Maybe it was knowledge was brought from another planet through contact. But again, on this theory, I've made so far 10 predictions that were documented that have been now verified. One of them, for example, is the explanation of the pioneer effect. You're familiar with this?
Oh, yeah, that's what, because of Pioneer 10 and 11, right?
Right.
When we launched those.
They were talking about a mysterious force pushing the craft towards the sun.
And then what did they assumed maybe planets had something to do with it. And now these things are out of the solar system. Who knows what's happening, right?
Right. Well, actually, back in 1980, this is before they even found this, I had contacted JPL, one of the people in that group, and asked them, saying it was to see if they were interested in testing this theory, because my physics theory was predicting that photons in the galaxy should blue shift. In other words, remember I said that the galaxy would be a region, a supercritical region, where it's creating energy, whereas out in beyond the galaxy, in the space between the galaxies, you have subcritical region. That's why you get the redshifting out there. So that's a way of generating the redshift that they see. So anyway, I told them I expect a blue shifting of photons, and have they seen anything in their maser signals to the spacecraft that would indicate a blue shifting?
And they said, Paul, hold that right there. We'll come back at the top of the hour. We'll wrap up talking about the Pioneer Effect, and we'll take phone calls with you, Paul, next hour. So now's your time. Now's your chance to chat with Paul Lavalette right here on Coast to Coast AM.